Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Robert Spano, the music director of the Atlanta Symphony. He was among the first of a new wave of young conductors to take up the leadership of major orchestras. He's in town to conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra this week. Susan Lewis explores this year's jazz-themed Philadelphia Flower Show. Jason Pfeiffer visits Baseball as America at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. And David Patrick Stearns profiles the American composer Elliot Carter, who celebrates his 100th birthday this year. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Robert Spano was just 40 years of age when he became music director of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 2001. He was at the time music director of the Brooklyn Philharmonic and maintained both positions until leaving Brooklyn in 2004. In his first six seasons in Georgia, Spano has raised the profile and standing of the Atlanta Symphony in the musical world and connected with Atlanta's disparate communities. With education and outreach complementing the music making in the concert hall, single ticket sales and subscriptions are on the rise, and donor support has purportedly increased by more than 40%. Although Spano satisfies the traditional classic music base with often inspired renditions of standard repertoire, he's also at the forefront in the commissioning of new work. So much so that a group of young composers, namely Jennifer Higdon, Christopher Theofanidis, Osvaldo Golioff, and Michael Gandolfi, whom Spano has repeatedly tapped, has become known as the Atlanta School. Robert Spano is among a group of young American composers in their early to mid-40s who, unlike the previous two generations, were neither schooled nor mentored by Leonard Bernstein. And although Bernstein's legacy still looms large over all of the American classical music world, these post-Bernsteinians may represent a new wave in conducting for the 21st century, an idea I put to Robert Spano when we met earlier this week.
I know that the fact of being at the helm of American orchestra, of an American orchestra, is very important to me in the sense that we are in a city that's very diverse, very multicultural, and there's a sense about our offerings and what we do musically that I think should reflect where we live. And we are in this experience of the global village, and so I know that we take a lot of care in the balance of things, that we're not only addressing the great tradition of 200 years of orchestral music, but also what's going on with all the amazing mergings of musics that have been going on in the last couple decades, especially, although it started in the early 20th century, like Reich combining Hebrew chant and African drumming, or Osvaldo Golioff mixing up Spanish plain song with flamenco with klezmer, or John Adams speaking so many different musical languages. I really believe Dr. Atomic is this fabulous combination of Schoenberg and Stravinsky. So there's all these amazing things going on musically right now in terms of how musics are melting into each other and emerging with this kind of, I don't know if it's Esperanto yet, but there's certainly something happening in terms of musical languages that's very exciting. And I think we reflect that as American cities and orchestras.
And you've been at the forefront of actually helping that process. You have the likes of Jennifer Higdon, who you've commissioned many times, Golioff, Theofanidis, the so-called Atlanta School.
Yes, I had the hubris to call it that. I woke up one morning and I was going to meet with my board, and what we did in Atlanta early on and continue to do is we made commitments to certain composers over multi-year periods rather than having a composer in residence. We opted to have a number of composers that we made long-term commitments to, sort of unofficial and ill-defined long-term commitments, but really enjoyable ones. And what's happened is our audiences know them very well. And I woke up one morning and realized these composers have something in common. These aren't just composers that we like and are interested in and love and want to keep working with. They also, despite their distinctive and independent voices, have an aesthetic identity that I think is as definable as the Russian Five or Lacis or any other thing in the history of music that you want to point to. And I think this is as noticeable and definable. And it's that they're tonal, they're tuneful, and they're all interested in world music or popular culture or both. And so they end up sounding completely different from each other in a way. So it's a fair assessment, I think, to say that there is something going on aesthetically of American composers of this generation.
And is that, do you think, why you've been attracted to their work?
Unconsciously, I think I was. And then it hit me like a brick a few years into it. I think we were 4 or 5 years into that commitment when it struck me that, this is what's going on. And then I started to see that they have precursors in David Del Tredici, in John Carigliano, mm-hmm. in Sam Barber, for that matter, in John Adams, because these were composers that were already outside of the, let's call it the academic school of Piston and Persichetti. And these are all great composers, but there is an aesthetic difference in what they're producing that I find fascinating.
Some would say that the great advantage of working with a living composer is that the person can be there in the room with you as you're reading the work. Some people would also say that the great disadvantage of working with a living composer is that the person is there in the room with you. What's been your experience?
Both. No, I'm excited to work with them, and they're my friends and colleagues, and I have such immense respect for them, and it is so helpful for me to be able to talk with them. And in fact, the composers I work with primarily are not. They're interested in what others are thinking about their music, too. They're not bringing the stone tablets down from the mountain. They're exploring something. Or as the Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore said, these people are trying to catch that vibrating thing. You know, that's wonderfully vague. And I think that's really what they're up to.
Atlanta Symphony music director Robert Spano. He conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in the final performance of a program featuring works by Stravinsky, Mozart, and Rachmaninoff tonight at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
This week, the Pennsylvania Convention Center has been transformed into a floral fantasy inspired by New Orleans. With more than 850 theatrical lights, 11 miles of cables, over 30 tractor-trailer loads of mulch, and, of course, millions of flowers, all forced into early bloom. With more than 250,000 visitors, the Philadelphia Flower Show today is a community event, boasting a regional economic impact of some $30 million. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the history, culture, and popularity of the Philadelphia Flower Show.
Philadelphia's much-beloved flower show is an illusion of sorts. Acres of beautiful flowers thrive in a setting more like an airline hangar than a garden. Instructive advice tempts would-be gardeners. Still, many exquisite and elaborate displays of forced blooms seem anything but practical or easy to replicate, at least to those of us without very green thumbs. In recent years, fantastical themes enhance the surreal experience of the event. This year, the theme is jazz, music you might associate with dark, smoky rooms.
It's not going to be smoky and dark. It's going to be bright and flowery, so we have to put our own flower show twist on it.
Director of design Sam Lemheny is involved in picking the theme each year. He found in the origins of jazz a metaphor for gardening.
Back at the turn of the century in New Orleans, when the music of the day was very straight and narrow, the musicians took that music and really put their own personal expression and feeling into the music and transformed it into an entirely new art form. It's really what I feel the flower show is all about. When our visitors come to the flower show, they see our exhibitors creating these amazing gardens that really inspire them to hopefully go home and do something different and unique.
Sparking creativity among the hundreds of thousands of visitors is only part of the goal of the flower show, now run by the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, where Jane Pepper is president.
Our mission is a very delicate balance between wow, it's spring, entertainment and education, and having the best horticulture that we possibly can.
And horticulture is where it all began. The Philadelphia Flower Show dates itself from 1829, 2 years after the birth of the Horticultural Society. Philadelphia itself had blossomed into a premier American city, a center of wealth and finance, art and science.
And in those days, it was the gentlemen showing off the new plants that they had received from someplace around the world and competing with their fellow estate people, with their fellow nursery people. And it grew from that.
Pepper says the first poinsettia was introduced here, and Mr. Burpee, of tomato fame, showed his plants. The Horticultural Society took over in the mid-1960s. The show was staged in the 33rd Street Armory for 2 years, then moved to the Civic Center. Ernesta Ballard, then president of the Horticultural Society, says Pepper, added talks and other education, which led to more widespread participation.
I always love to think about Sylvia Lynn, who is one of our very wonderful exhibitors, a woman now in her 70s, and she came to the show with her husband back in the probably early 70s, and she looked at the begonias, and she said, "My begonias are better than these," and she started to exhibit.
In 1996, the flower show took a huge leap, landing in the Pennsylvania Convention Center. It now spreads out over 10 acres. Plants range from familiar favorites like daffodils, which are easy to force into bloom, and daylilies, which are not, to new varieties, which may or may not do well. Forcing blooms involves skill, knowledge, and some finesse.
Figuring out how long that plant has to be in the cooler in the fall to trick it to thinking that it's been through the winter, how long you have to have it in a greenhouse, and then things like underbench heating, carbon dioxide, there are all kinds of little tricks that our growers produce in order to get the plants in bloom at the right time.
Today, the show has hundreds of exhibits, from the large-scale areas by local landscapers and nurseries to pressed plants from as far away as Japan and Bulgaria, from group projects submitted by schools and garden clubs to tiny plants raised in single pots, which make up the show's competitive classes. Turns out the competitive part of the flower show is a bit like a dog show, without the barking or the pooper scoopers. Every plant has its own ideal proportion and presentation.
For example, if it's a plant that has to be in bloom, it's a question of how the blooms look. It has to be in the right scale with the pot. And with each plant, there is a card which has the scientific name and also the common name so that a person could go and find it in a greenhouse.
Yet the flower show today is not all competition and education for the gardeners among us.
I equate it to when you go to a Broadway show. The music is strong. It hits you.
Robert Lamsback and his wife Karen are the floral decorators for the show's central exhibit. These are the floral displays that greet visitors when they walk through the door.
I want people to be captivated, to be transformed out of the daily woes of life. You may not be able to design this or do this at home, but for that moment, you are brought to another dimension, and that's what my goal has been for 18 years.
When they're not working with the flower show, Robert and Karen Lamsback do floral decorating for events. Their purpose here is more to entertain than educate. Their approach, more like artists. This year, he describes their designs as less traditional or European and more contemporary, with an Asian influence.
They're singular specimen flowers, like beautiful orchids or else like calla lilies that have beautiful movement to them, that have lines to them. It's more of an art design than just a mass of flowers.
In the first of six so-called rhythm rooms, suspended triangles filled with flowers hover above a fountain. Another room is red and black, with red roses purchased from overseas.
Then there's another one masked in hot pink and orange flowers with glass ornaments hanging from it with some feathers in it. I mean, there's a lot of different mediums we're mixing together that are usually not mixed together.
Artistic experiments can be risky, but Lamsback says when the unexpected happens,
you have to think quick, and when in doubt, just add more flowers.
In fact, adding more flowers goes on all week long. Lamsback exhibits will be refreshed every night and changed completely three times during the week. Creating a feeling of springtime and making time stand still, the flower show is just that. A show, a performance, a spectacle of color and design, staged by people who love plants, for those who might or might not pick up a trowel and give it a try.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Philadelphia Flower Show opens tomorrow and runs through March 9th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. With spring training in full swing and Major League Baseball's opening day about 4 weeks away, many are looking forward to a new season of baseball. It's been this way for some time. Since the mid-1800s, baseball has been dubbed America's national pastime. For the past 6 years, an exhibition called Baseball as America has been touring the country. The National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown organized the show, which examines the relationship between the sport and American culture. This exhibition is now at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, a venue, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, that also explores other parts of history that are quintessentially American.
Baseball as America has visited natural history museums, science museums, and historical societies across the country. That these venues and Philadelphia's Constitution Center have been temporary homes for the touring presentation is telling. Speaking from Cooperstown, New York, Ted Spencer, Vice President and Chief Curator of the Baseball Hall of Fame, says Baseball as America is much more than a showcase for sports history.
The whole idea behind the exhibit was to tell a story that baseball is just not about bats, balls, and gloves, or runs, hits, and errors. It's about American people and their lives and their connection to their own lives through baseball.
Spencer came up with the idea for the Baseball as America exhibition over a decade ago. He wanted a King Tut tour of baseball in the U.S., presenting the history and themes of baseball as a reflection of American culture. Baseball as America opened in New York City in 2002 and has since traveled to 13 cities. Spencer says that as a town that had a team during the first year of professional baseball, Philadelphia was always a top pick as a host city. However, because for a long time a suitable venue couldn't be found, the exhibit almost didn't come to Philadelphia until the National Constitution Center expressed interest. CEO of the Constitution Center, Joe Torsella, says Baseball as America is perfect for his institution.
There are so many points of overlap between the story of baseball and the story of our country that are illuminated by this exhibit that it really is natural for us to have it here.
Torsella quotes essayist Gerald Early, who famously remarked that there are only three things America will be known for 2,000 years from now: the Constitution, jazz, and baseball.
And you can get two out of three with a visit to the Constitution Center these days.
Baseball as America spans over 6,000 square feet and includes over 500 artifacts. Walking into the entrance, a display case speaker trumpets the national anthem, marking the first of the exhibition's seven sections. Linking baseball to longtime traditions of patriotism, like the president annually throwing out the season's first pitch, the National Spirit section sets the stage for exploration of other themes like entrepreneurial enterprise, innovation, team spirit, and sharing a common culture. Whether or not people even know the rules of baseball, the sport has long been deeply rooted in popular culture.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
Baseball references like three strikes and you're out and ballpark figures are commonly thrown around in casual conversation. In many ways, baseball has had a mesmerizing, even spiritual, effect on Americans. Rebecca Alpert, chair of Temple University's religion department, is currently working on a book about baseball in Jewish culture. She says the sport has long helped form bonds among Americans from many different backgrounds.
There is something to the idea that sports provide an opportunity for people to find meaning in life, which is really basically what religion is about. So in the 20th century, baseball was America's religion. I mean, it was what brought Americans together.
Alpert says the very fact that the Baseball as America exhibit exists, with a bat from Babe Ruth to the helmet of Jimmy Rollins, speaks to the sacredness that baseball and its icons hold for many.
You think about the actual tangible items that people use in order to evoke their sense of worship or their sense of awe.
But even for those who are ambivalent about or just don't care for baseball, Alpert says the significance of the sport has resonance with social issues far beyond the ballpark. Baseball was one of the places America's color barrier was broken, with Jackie Robinson's 1947 debut in the major leagues.
It said a lot about what America was prior to World War II and said a lot about what America was after World War II.
Jackie Robinson's jersey and display cases about black baseball leagues are part of the Baseball as America show. The Baseball Hall of Fame's Ted Spencer says that pieces like these reflect the controversial and troubled past of baseball and America, with its racism, corruption, and many injustices.
And so we have good days and we have bad days, just like any other group of humans. So, you know, on the very first second that we started down this road, we knew that we were going to deal with the neat things, the high points, but we were going to deal with the things that reflect negatively on the game and on the country.
Philadelphia is not exempted from this warts and all story. It was among the last cities to integrate its teams. Yet although the city hasn't always had an admirable baseball past, it has historically been one of the most important baseball towns, with two professional teams until the mid-1950s, the Athletics and the Phillies. This legacy is celebrated in the Philadelphia incarnation of Baseball as America. A special case with Philly baseball artifacts was created for the Constitution Center stop. It includes Richie Ashburn's spikes, the cap Jim Bunning wore during his 1964 perfect game, a Mike Schmidt bat, and a Steve Carlton jersey. Baseball as America will next head to Boston for 2.5 months before the tour comes to a close and the exhibit is put to rest. But the passion for baseball in Philadelphia and the rest of the country surely won't be put to rest anytime soon. The nostalgia, hero worship, and love of the game continue to draw millions of people, reflecting and creating American culture. Though the season to hear the crack of the bat and eat lukewarm, soggy hot dogs at the ballpark is not yet here, the limited engagement of Baseball as America offers the baseball fan in winter hibernation and anyone just curious about American culture the opportunity to imagine, at least for now, that they're out at the ballpark.
Cause it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old
Philly Empire. WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Baseball as America is at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia through May 11th. This is Creatively Speaking on WRTI. I'm Jim Cotter. Sometimes you can't always tell when the musicians are tuning up for Elliot Carter or actually playing his music. Not because the 99-year-old composer's work sounds like noise, but because it sounds like life. Though hailed as America's greatest living composer, and maybe even America's greatest composer period, Carter is being heard with particular frequency in the months leading up to his 100th birthday in December. He'll celebrate with premieres of several newly composed works he's finished in the past year. The Network for New Music is giving a Carter tribute tomorrow afternoon at the main branch of the Settlement Music School, with more Carter to come in Philadelphia Chamber Music Society concerts by Pierre-Laurent Aimard and musicians from Marlborough later this month. Even so, this Pulitzer Prize-winning composer is seldom heard here. Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns has followed Carter for years and discovers that it's hardly just a matter of dissonance.
And that's the first two notes of the piece.
Right, exactly. He doesn't repeat them, but I think he actually has something like, I think it's like literally...
Composer Jennifer Higdon's music stands at the tonal opposite of Elliot Carter's tightly packed modernism. She's one of 10 composers commissioned to write for the Network for New Music's 10 for Carter concert. And her way of doing so was to pluck some things from Carter's celebrated triple duo and build her own kind of piece from it titled Mr. Carter's Notes. And in doing so, she discovered that Carter's dissonances, much dreaded in some circles, are merely skin deep.
I went through and pulled out a bunch of gestures. I took the first two notes of the piece, which are... And I made those kind of a thematic thing in my particular piece. Are things that actually happen in the Carter, just in a very different sort of context. And spread out, he has events happening within 3 seconds. So he'll have 16 events happening. It takes 3 seconds for one event of mine to actually unfold. So it's just a different speed altogether.
Behind Carter's music, you don't find theoretical experimentation, but a highly personal sensibility formed when he first heard Stravinsky's Rite of Spring and responded to all the clashing chords that came with it. Like Stravinsky, Carter isn't out to communicate an airbrushed version of real life. But unlike Stravinsky, he's not commenting on modern violence through some balletic scenario about pagan Russia. This remarkably friendly but uncompromising composer represents a stubborn alternative to anything artificial or flimsy, and particularly to the world of the hard sell.
I'm very much concerned throughout all of my life to avoid the idea of mechanical repetition, because it seemed to me that we were being deluged by advertising, by propaganda. This is something that I've tried specifically to fight, and so my music has always tried to reflect the human side of things.
That's Elliot Carter in the Frank Sheffer film A Labyrinth of Time, with a kind of observation born out of having grown up in New York City in an age when he could ride his bicycle to the southern tip of Manhattan and not see a single automobile. Rather than conveying nostalgia for the past, however, Carter suggests that the best place is the present, by enshrining modern life in all of its randomness. That aesthetic, however, is hard won. Carter's never fallen back on pre-established systems of composing, certainly not the surrealists that were all the rage when he was formulating his musical language in the 1950s. Carter is about freedom of music with the rhythm of prose rather than poetry, and never falling into the trap of trading new sets of limitations for old. Elliot Carter wrote some of his most important works in the 1960s and 70s, though Network for New Music director Linda Reichert believes he truly bloomed in the mid-1980s with Triple Duo. She had hoped to feature that piece on Sunday's concert, but scheduling the long and necessary rehearsal time was impossible. Even with the 4-minute work for clarinet, violin, and cello titled Con Leggerezza Penosa, musicians rehearse for 10 hours, discovering that once everything is in its right place, it should sound like it's in the wrong place. Though for good reasons, says Network violinist Gloria Justin.
We all have different divisions of the beat, and you know, things are not supposed to sound together. So we all have to have our inner pulse going very strong, and then we've written in a lot of cues, and you know, we hope we come out at the same time at certain key points. I do think this piece has a sense of humor. There are little sparkly gestures that happen, pizzicati, that are they're not together, but they're in the same gesture as if we're playing a game with each other. And then loud outbursts of chords, and there's even a mad fiddler that arrives, you know, at some point in the piece. There are some jazzy elements, syncopated rhythms. So I think there are a lot of fun listening discoveries to be made.
Her colleague, cellist Thomas Cranes, sums it up this way.
Because what he's after, even with this piece, is the idea of three different people sort of not paying attention to each other, which is very New York, you know, and maybe a little less Philadelphia, but yeah.
Okay, so Elliot Carter isn't as American as apple pie. He's as American as a traffic jam, or in the case of his opera, What Next?, a car accident, which is what occurs in its opening moments. His music feels like a passionate conversation that might turn nasty or end in raucous laughter. It also reflects a strong American work ethic and the kind of pioneering spirit that either requires great courage or a creative drive that won't take no or silence for an answer. He has no masks, no pretensions. What's not so American, though, is his music's ability to defy explanation. That's partly because Carter loves orchestrating simultaneous musical events, much like Guglielmo Machaut in the 14th century or the Beatles' song collage Revolution No. 9 in the 1960s. But is it art or artistic accident? You could ask the same thing of a bird song that, like Carter's music, goes by so fast you really can't pick it apart or tell what it's saying. In a world that demands explanations, loving Carter's music means letting it go unexplained.
Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Elliot Carter in tomorrow's paper. The Philadelphia Chamber Music Society presents two concerts this month that include work by Elliot Carter, the first featuring pianist Pierre-Laurent Aimar on Tuesday, March 18th, and on the following night, the Musicians of Marlborough. Both performances take place at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Zavit Schlenk and myself, with thanks also this week to Lauren Saul, Laura Beitman, and Ashley Burke. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.